This is a National Arts Center podcast. Find more great NAC podcasts on the performing arts at nacpodcast.ca or search on National Arts Center on iTunes and subscribe for free.
Welcome to the Hexagon Studio. This is Marjolaine Fournier. I'm sitting here with Jean-Jacques Van Vlasla, and today we're revisiting a favorite of ours, Bruckner, and his Ninth Symphony.
Anton Bruckner in the Ninth Symphony, the final one.
And what's interesting about this symphony is, in fact, he was working on it the morning, the very day that he died. He was still working on it, and there are only three movements usually played. Now, there's been a trend, people getting together, committees, putting together something of a fourth movement. But really, what he composed and what he had finished was the ninth with three movements, and I'm quite happy with that.
Yeah, so am I.
it ends, it's quite long still, and it ends peacefully, which is something I like. Now, he wrote this at the end of his life. He was quite old by that time. He didn't die young like so many geniuses that we've studied. And this is the culmination
indeed
of his life in music. Yeah. He was a very pious man. Mm-hmm. I wonder if there are views of heaven in this piece or hell, or if he was at peace when he was working on this. What do you think?
Well, this is the fundamental question around this symphony. Well, when one talks about heaven, then one implies always hell anyhow. And so one goes with the other. And I do think that it is it's a very complex moment in his life, and he's asking himself questions. And we are, and whatever we say about his symphonies that have been called masses without words, this one he dedicates to God. It is. He had dedicated the second symphony to Liszt, the third symphony to Wagner, but this one was really his ultimate work. It was his ultimate cry of what he had been working on throughout his life. And his life is a long quest. It's a long quest to a long ascension towards the ideal. That ideal which he had an inkling of in his youth, and that last symphony is a very generous offering to the master of the universe. But behind that, there is a human being, and a human being that is torn because he's still asking the same questions, questions about belief, and not necessarily the system of the church, because he was very much within that system of the church. He had been living most of his time between Vienna at the end, in the beginning of his life, my God, very close in St. Florian, in that wonderful convent, and later an abbey, where he worked for many years, more than 10 years between his 15th and 25th year. And this man who came out of peasantry has been going on and on, from one symphony to another symphony, from one mass to another mass, from one choir to another choir. He's a great choir composer. He's a great organ composer. And that organ he has expanded within the orchestra. So this quest and this continuous road towards the end, because this symphony is also a farewell to the world, like Mahler's two last works, the Song of the Earth and the Ninth Symphony, this is the equivalent of what Mahler. But Mahler is a very different character. Mahler is a city person. Mahler is Jewish. Mahler is torn from the inside. He found peace in what religion was given to him throughout his life, but he was alone, very alone, with that quest. And that is what's being said in this work. You know, one of the great conductors today, Nicolas Arnoncourt, said, the two gods, that thing, two gods, which he puts in his symphony, is with Bruckner, the motivation, the engine, the dedication of his life and work, of his belief, of his raison d'être, as we say in French, for his blessing, but also his worry. And when Bruckner believed, he created. And when his faith wavered, his self-confidence with it, his reason, started to crumble. And that's what we have. That's what we have in this Ninth Symphony. And especially, of course, in the first and in the second movement. The third movement is going back into peace, which was necessary. And when you mentioned in the very beginning of your intervention that the day of his death in October 1896, he was still working on the third movement. Not on the fourth movement. He was still working on the Adagio, of which there are many, many initial versions. He continued working. He had worked on the last movement. So yes, there are 484 bars written or in his drafts, more than 200 pages. But he never got it together. The triumph of the last movement never was there. The triumph of his belief was perhaps not there. What he does, he ends with an adagio, and it must have happened inside him. And that adagio goes into the emptiness and the end of life.
The adagio is so tender and gentle. And for a man who never knew tenderness and gentleness, a companion. But there's moments in there of horrible, there's some horrible moments in the adagio also. Chords and tension and anxiety.
Yes,
and but he gets out of it, thankfully.
And you're so right, in a way that when one reads the music well, one sees that he's opening up to the post-romantic period. Mm. You know, Schoenberg is in there.
He was overheard. I was reading a book called Bruckner Remembered. Mm-hmm. So it's anecdotes, people who have, you know, a chambermaid here mm-hmm. or a doctor here or a friend mm-hmm. here. They have short anecdotes about Bruckner. And one of them is that, first of all, if he heard church bells ring from anywhere, he would stop everything and pray. But and somebody overheard him pray during that time when he was writing this Ninth Symphony. And he'd say, Dear Lord, he'd say, like, I don't know how many Our Fathers and then Hail Marys. Then he'd say a personal prayer, which was, Dear Lord, I'm writing this for you. I'm dedicating this symphony for you. Please let me finish. If you don't, it's on you. It's your fault. If I don't finish, it's your fault. That's pretty strong.
That's pretty strong. He said about the same thing to somebody who came to see him. And we're talking in 1894 when he was very ill. You know, he had a kind of illness which is called hydropsia. Hydropsia, that is, hydropsia is in the lungs, water that comes up in the lungs. And pleurisie in French, you know, pleurisia, I think, is also the word in English. So these were coughing. He had a problem in the larynx, at the level of the larynx also. They never knew really what that was about. He was quite an ill man in the nine last years of his life, and the nine last years of his life correspond to the first writings about the Ninth Symphony. So he worked for 9 years on that symphony without finishing that last movement.
He did suggest about the last movement. He kind of knew that it wasn't going to happen, even though he had those mm-hmm. 400 bars. And he said, maybe I should put the Te Deum, something he
Absolutely.
Wrote earlier, in there. Now, I understand that the keys are very important to Bruckner, the tonalities. Mm-hmm. And so the Te Deum was in C major.
Yeah. Which is a very different thing because the whole of the symphony is a D minor symphony, and it's exactly the D minor symphony which is a tonality which was used by Beethoven in his Ninth Symphony also, which was used by Mozart in his Requiem Mass, which was used by Bach in the Art of the Fugue. So there is something there that goes towards final works also. And it has to do also with the mood, of course, of the work, and the mood of the work is that same kind of final work, but at the same time, this work is something that tends towards a human farewell. Beethoven is very different. Is a very different work. It is not a farewell. It is trying to find back what came true at a given moment in the history of humanity, which was called Enlightenment. This is 25 years after, 30 years after Enlightenment, and when everything went wrong in society, like, you know, like today, people don't feel very much at ease. There are things happening that people don't want to, you know, to make people feel. It's not a happy period in the history of humanity. Well, the same thing in the 1820s when Beethoven wrote the Ninth Symphony. So this is a very egocentrical work. I'm talking about the Ninth Symphony of Bruckner. Now, then very egocentrical work. It is the quest of that one person towards eternity and the quest of existence.
What I
Yes, let me. I wanted to come back to what you said, yes. That anecdote, which has existed in a different way. Somebody came to visit him, and I'm talking 1894, 2 years before he dies. I have done my duty on earth, he says to this person. I have accomplished what I could in my and my final wish is to be allowed to finish my Ninth Symphony. Three movements are almost complete, the adagio nearly finished, there remains only the finale. I trust that death will not deprive me from my pen. So, to that person, he speaks about death depriving him of the pen. In what you gave us, God deprives me of a pen.
That's so very different.
There's a very different thing between the God and the death as such.
So that's 2 years before his death.
Yeah.
He's already pretty much, he's doing quite well with his composition. But and I have to say that when I listened, I listened to the symphony much long time before I started reading about it. And at my first listen, I thought, this is a piece. Some people don't like Bruckner because he expands too much, but what I could hear, and I think it's got to do with the version I was listening to, Bruno Walter's version. It's a composition, I thought, of a man who has all the time in the world. You don't feel that push that other composers have to get somewhere. He's taking his sweet time. I'm not sure now that I was right about that.
You're right. No. Your intuition is right. You have used the word expands. How does he want to show that there is something beyond our human existence? Because that's what he's after, finally, yeah. Fundamentally. And only music can do that. You know, only music can do that. And I must say, there is a French poet, Baudelaire, who said, music fetches heaven. And now that definition, and music fetches heaven. I mean, I have been translating this from French, and I will say it in French because it has to do with it, the finesse of the words. La musique creuse le ciel. So it opens up heaven. It goes and gets heaven. Well, at the same time.
That's an exquisite sentence from Baudelaire, who was quite a dark
yes,
poet.
Yes, but who lives at the same time as Bruckner. And so I don't know if he has ever heard symphonies by Bruckner. I don't know. I don't think so. It would be an interesting thing to know. So,
but this is perfect.
Yeah. And you gave a second element, the expansion. Now, that expansion is necessary. He has to, you know, there must be an ascending element. But the ascending element with Bruckner very often is broken down. So the melodies go forward and then suddenly he cracks, he stops the whole thing. And there are moments of silence. There are these extraordinary moments where nothing moves anymore. And where you have the emptiness, but also the fullness of the whole music behind it in that moment when there is no sound anymore. And what he does, he expands as much as he can, and that expansion comes through all kinds of technical elements. But by expanding, he transforms the notion of time also, because space is the basis of the transformation of time also. So what he does, he plays around with the notion of time. And suddenly, when it's very well conducted, suddenly there are moments where you feel into the eternity, into emptiness, into whatever, the infinite. And again, when he finishes that last movement, that adagio, which I think is, it is a floating, sublimely, ultimately, like ultimate moment, ultimately, and it disappears into the ether of the close of that movement after an hour of alternating struggles and victories and defeats and human life.
Light and dark and hell and heaven and
so
all that.
Yeah. He tries to open it as much as possible. Now, Bruno Walter was a remarkable conductor. You mentioned Bruno Walter. But there are conductors today that have... They're still around. Well, not all of them, but a conductor like Carlo Maria Giulini knew how to play Bruckner. He had that incredible breath in him, and at the same time, the great precision on which those symphonies are built, because that too is very important. You know, the symphonies open up wide spaces, reveal deep thoughts, are overwhelming us with solemnity and monumentality,
yeah.
And it is majestic. Mega music, if I can say it like that.
But it's
and
mega.
Yet, its greatness
so
lies in meticulously elaborated
yes.
details, in its rich and compact inner workings.
Yeah, that Bruckner, you say it's mega, and but it's such an intimate experience. When you listen, he reaches right into you,
yeah.
If you give it time.
And there is something that you mentioned also in that that intervention of yours a few minutes ago, which I didn't want to let go past. You know, sometimes we forget about what is being said because it's such a rich there is such a rich contents in front of us. But it was his tenderness. It's the most tender of beings. That is beyond there. It's somebody who seems to be lost. But in that tenderness, there's so much love. There's so much love. I mean, there's... And in the work itself, in that extraordinary mega music, suddenly you have a theme coming up. And that theme just cracks you, kills you, gets you out of the way.
It's like a hand stroking the cheek of a child sometimes, very much.
And I must say, what he does in that ninth symphony, in the three movements that are there, he puts in there major moments of his compositions. That is, he goes back. He goes back to the Mass in D minor. Aha, D minor Mass. He goes to the Kyrie and to the Miserere. So there you have the two oppositions also. So he takes fragments, motifs out of the Kyrie and the Miserere. But then he goes also to his Mass in F major, and he goes to the Benedictus and puts that into his symphony. And he quotes the fugued theme of the finale of the Fifth Symphony. Then he goes to the principal theme of the Seventh Symphony, which is that most extraordinary tender moment, which he will use in the last movement in the Adagio. It's, I think, the slow movement of the Seventh Symphony is, and that theme is most probably one of the greatest moments in classical music. And, well, he must have known it, that it was not a bad tune. I mean, and he brought it back into his Ninth Symphony. But he goes also, he takes an element out, a citation out of the Adagio of the Eighth Symphony. You know, it's, and all that in the perspective of the D minor, you know, Mozart's Requiem, Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, Bach's Art of the Fugue. You say to yourself, he was there. He knew he was there. And he died the day he was still working on that part of the symphony.
It's
on
a
the
bit
Adagio.
Of a coda. Here's a coda.
Yeah, here's
life.
A coda. I mean, that's what I did. That's what I think I did well. And at the same time, it's a thank you piece. It's a farewell piece. It's going beyond. And only music can do that. Only music, because only music can play with the notion of time. And that's what great composers do. That's what great conductors do when they know this. Of course, conductors need the internal breath to understand the breath that is in that symphony, to get that thing out. And there are a few, of course, in the world that can do that. There are people. And there is something very interesting, and there could be a discussion for another time. Great Mahler conductors are not necessarily great Bruckner conductors, and great Bruckner conductors are not necessarily great Mahler conductors. There is a very, very, very interesting thing. It's a very different comprehension, or a different take of what the world is about. And so we have this extraordinary symphony, ninth symphony, final symphony, that came from this little man who, naive, badly dressed, kept his accent of high Austria, that part around Linz, Ansfelden, St. Florian, where he went when he was ill, and where he studied for so long, where he lived. He lived in the convent for 10 years, and where he would go, and when he was even going on holidays. You know, Brahms would go on holidays to Italy. Tchaikovsky would go on holidays to Paris and to New York. Mahler would conduct the New York Philharmonic Orchestra. When he went on holidays, he went to his convent in St. Florian. It is an extraordinary story of a it's not, he's not a simple, people say he's a simple man. He was not a simple man. I mean, he had that incredible knowledge of the earth, of simplicity, of the peasants of the time, of the farmers of the time. That's where he came from, notwithstanding the fact that there was a musical genes in the family, you know, with father and the uncles, etc. And that's where he learned his that's where he did his first steps in music. But all that, you know, his father's idealism, his mother, who was a very pious person, very, very, very simple, pious person, worked hard all her life. He tried to help her at a given moment when his father died, when he was still quite young, 14 or 15. And that's when he went into the convent. Of course, they took him because they knew there was a great musician. This convent in St. Florian, one has to know the convent to feel what Bruckner is like, because it's an extraordinary place. It's an extraordinary place which was founded, in the 4th century, but which was rebuilt 3 or 4 times and has this extraordinary Baroque presence, brought within a marvelous organ. And the organs of that church, of the church, have been the organs where he played and where he returned when he died. He wanted to be buried in the crypt of St. Florian. And so when one is in the church and when one faces the organs, one stands in fact on the stone that recalls his memory. And he lies there underneath his organ. I mean, it's a very, very, very interesting story of a willpower towards grandeur, and trying to explain what he felt to the glory of God.
And that's interesting. You say he was aspiring to grandeur. He wanted to be recognized. He knew that, in fact, one of the ways that he kind of proves that he knew how great his music was, that he made sure that his music would go to the National Library in Vienna.
Yeah.
So that's, I mean, I'm not sending anything the National. He knew. But at the same time, he was so modest and humble that he let just about anybody tell him, you should fix this piece. You should take this out. And I thought at first when I read this that the corrections that people were suggesting were to make his music more sophisticated. But it's not so. It's to make it more so that the auditor would be more pleased. Yeah. His music was quite complicated to the contemporary.
Absolutely.
So he let people tell him what to do with his symphonies. He was an admirer of Wagner. He apparently he was only on his knees for God and Wagner.
Wagner, yes.
But
Wagner liked him very much. And Wagner, there are all kinds of anecdotes, you know, to show that his insecurity and his search for security in God, of course. I mean, it's full of. It seems to be simple. It seems to be straightforward. It is not at all. And the Ninth Symphony, like the Seventh, and like the Eighth Symphony, carry all this. They carry all this. I wanted what you were saying about these people that are the arrogance of some of those people that intervened. It went until the 2nd of April 1932 that his original score of the Ninth Symphony was being played. 1932, and now mind you, 1932 is the beginning of the Nazi era in Germany, and Bruckner, of course, has been one of those victims of Nazi culture, because they put him at the highest pedestal, together with Wagner.
They loved that
mega music, you know, that extraordinary momentality. Monumentality. I mean, that was in it, and forgot about all the openings, all the silences that are in there, all those quests, that continuous quest of something he had foreseen somewhere in his youth as a little boy. I mean,
it's interesting that you bring this up, and I just read recently that the Hitler liked Bruckner very much because he felt they had an affinity. They were both from
the same city, yes.
The country, yeah, very simple, and they doing great things in theory.
Yes, well, Well, we won't open that can
no.
of worms.
No, no.
We won't. But I want to save Bruckner from Nazi culture.
The thing about Bruckner that we were talking earlier together about this is I picture a very pious, simple, good, very good man. And I couldn't imagine, and you straightened me out. I couldn't imagine a man so good being able to imagine, as he's picturing the end of his life, and being able to portray something so peaceful and heavenly. But he's also able to describe maybe hell, and I couldn't imagine that. And you corrected me and you said, oh, he was simple. He was pious. But he was very complicated also, and he was torn.
It's false simplicity. I mean, I don't believe in purity. I don't believe in simplicity. I mean, the human beings are cognitive machines at work continuously, and they can do all kinds of things, go all kinds of sides. But, you know, he was kind of saved by that original learning of, and you know, that original existence he had within his family, within the countryside, within Linz, within St. Florian, and then his natural humility. There was a natural humility. There are, you know, some of the greatest people are the most humble. And this is an idea that we can get into another day also, if you want.
Yeah.
But, you know, a person like him writing that bewegt und lebhaft, this very vivacious scherzo, which is the second movement to this symphony, which is one of the most beautiful, most massive, the most terrifying scherzos. They resemble very much, well, sometimes the scherzos of Mahler are nicer, much more landly.
Oh, yeah. Country-like.
But here we have Dante's second circle. I mean, you know, we are, and it's a world in which, you know, it's, in French we would say impitoyable, it's without any, you know, stopping, you know, with acid orchestration, and we have talked about that, you know, that acid orchestration that is in there and that opens up to new kinds of writings. The writings, you know, and we have to talk about something in the inside of the symphony, all his symphonies in a way. He's the man who works on 1, 2, 3 themes. In each of his movements, there are three different themes. Most of the, you know, the great classical ones are two themes and all kinds of variations on that, of course. And then, you know, you work these things out during the movement of the symphony. So he did it three. But this is the Holy Trinity also. Mm-hmm. And the Holy Trinity, I mean, and it breaks the dualism, the opposition of good and bad. And suddenly there is that opening of the number thirds, which is, you know, the world is not one or not another. There is a third element that plays.
That's fascinating, because he loved the classical, the form. He loved form, he loved numbers, he loved perfection of numbers. And the sonata form is perfection. If you're coming up through the normal Schubert school and everything, it's
but with the third theme,
yeah,
he just opens that so-called perfection, that so-called classical structure, and he opens it to the winds of whatever, and so he broadens and he breaks open the symphony. He breaks open the symphony and he offers perspectives that you never had before. And that's how he changes also the notion of time, because the notion of space has changed within the symphony. It is an extraordinary symphony, and one of those things that one has to go and listen to, and one has to say to oneself, okay, just I'll take it from here. Just let me take me with you. Which he does when you have a good conductor who knows to read through the lines.
He gently guides you through. That's for sure. Bruckner guides you. It's a little bit, I was trying to figure out what irritates people with Bruckner. And I think it's not Bruckner. It's the fact that we don't like to stop. And you have to stop. It's like, I remember being a young girl in church and getting completely distracted and bored. And we were allowed to draw so that time would pass faster. But this is the thing. This is a mass that you want to sit, take off your watch, and just take it in. And then it works.
And be ready to be insecure.
Oh.
I was listening to you, and I said to myself, okay, why do have people difficulties? Well, they want to be certain. Well, you know, it's so nice to have a Mozart symphony because you know where you will end up. You will end up in pure happiness.
In a garden.
You will end up regardless. You know, the last movement will bring, it will be dancing, it will be happy, it will be going forward and things like that. With this guy, no. You be ready to be taken out of your habits. Be ready to be listening to somebody who tried to stop the world, to try to stop the world and to see, try to say, take one step further. And in that stoppage, and the stoppage moments in a symphony by Bruckner are extraordinary. But the stoppage moments help you create the new space.
Yeah,
I think that does it.
And in the darkness and light with Bruckner, there's always love.
And it's fundamental. It's absolutely fundamental. There is no way. Every movement, every opening, every construction, every theme are themes of love. The greatest love theme ever composed. It's not Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet. It is that little theme somewhere in the Adagio of the Seventh Symphony, which he will reuse for this Adagio to finish his life and his work.
Jean-Jacques, thank you so much. We'll talk again soon.
This has been a National Arts Center podcast produced in Ottawa by NAC New Media. Send us your comments and questions. Email us at nacpodcasts@gmail.com. Visit the podcast section of the iTunes store, where you can rate and comment on this podcast. We love to hear from you. Remember, you can find more great NAC podcasts at nacpodcast.ca or search on National Arts Center on iTunes and subscribe for free. Until next time, goodbye from Canada's National Arts Center.